This podcast was originally live streamed on the Non Sequitur Show on YouTube. New episodes air weekdays, Monday through Friday, at 8 p.m. Eastern at youtube.com/nonsequiturshow. Make sure you never miss a live stream by visiting www.nonsecshow.com/schedule. For the latest news, polls and updates throughout the day, follow us on Twitter, at nonsecshow or facebook.com/nonsecshow. That's NONSEQ show. If you'd like to get exclusive content, bi-weekly private hangouts with Kyle and Steve, backstage access to chat with guests after shows hosted on your channel and much more, become a Patreon saint of Non Sequitur. It ensures we continue to improve our show and brings you into the process at the same time. Visit patreon.com/nonsequitur today while the limited spots are still available.
The following podcast is intended for those who believe bold ideas are righteous, unique perspectives are gospel, and strong opinions are sacred. This is Non Sequitur. Never follow. And now, here are your hosts, Kyle Curtis and Steve McRae.
It's a good thing I could be ready on a dime. There was no earbud warning that time. Dave, what are you trying to do to us? I did not. But here we are, nonetheless. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Non Sequitur. If you watched last night, it was epic. If you haven't seen it yet, you need to go back and watch the events that unfolded with our incel friends. The first two-thirds of the show were actually pretty calm, and it was a good conversation. But after that, it dissolved very quickly. What did you think, Steve?
I wouldn't even say it dissolved. It was like a slow, epic crescendo, and then all of a sudden it just went, and then went kind of. But I mean, it was definitely interesting, and I think that actually a lot of people were making points. But I got to tell you, the best part was just watching Shannon go ballistic. I really thoroughly enjoyed that for some reason.
Yep. She was shaking. And,
she was pissed, and she had a right to be.
That voice that you hear, by the way, is we go ahead and bring Katie Paulson back on. This will be, I think this is your fourth appearance in 2 weeks. I think you have a record.
So, I know.
Welcome back.
Hi, guys. Smoking
Gun, we're going to update you guys on one of our favorite guests that we've done several episodes now on. Our favorite cabbage juice, salt-flavored death peddler, Jilly Juice, made the news again today. So we felt it was only appropriate to bring Katie on to let us know what was going on. So, Katie, what is happening with Crazy Jilly?
So, Crazy Jilly has been going a little bit nuts over the last few days and weeks, if you've noticed, on her Facebook, trying to get people to substantiate her claims that people can regrow limbs, cure cancer, reverse Down syndrome, all of that stuff. There was an ongoing investigation. Cure the gate, correct. And she was actively looking for people to share their testimonies that these products were, that her protocol was doing what she said it was going to do. All of that was in what most of us estimate was like a scramble for her to be able to prove to the Ohio Attorney General and the Ohio Attorney General and the FTC that she wasn't making unsubstantiated claims. So today, Jillian received a letter via FedEx and took to her favorite social media platform, Facebook, where she has 6,000 followers. I think 5,999 are probably trolls. To tell us that the FTC had dropped off a letter. And in the letter, the FTC notified her that she must retract all of her claims, statements, and misleading advertising regarding her protocol.
Boom.
She cannot, boom, right? She cannot say her products cure anything. She cannot say her products reverse anything. She cannot even say there's a possibility that her product will do this. She has to completely scrub her website. She has to remove her first book. She has to remove any of her like papers that have like the scientific data behind them. And so she actually thought this was a win, right? Which was the most disturbing part of this is in her video, she's going, yes, right?
Because so in her video, right?
No. So she was saying the government is helping her because her website contained so much free information, right? And so because of that, no one was having to buy her book. So because the FTC, oh, she still thinks she can.
That's the funny part.
Do it.
Oh yeah. Let me ask you quick. Do you think she's going to buy money in this? Because I don't see that happening. She's a nutter, so she's not going to care about this. She'll find a way to try to circumvent it, and she's going to get. What happens if she does? What are the liabilities that she's incurring?
Well, here's the deal: because this like was sort of breaking right around dinner time, and I had some of your amazing Discord followers letting me know about what was going on. I was writing an article and doing some research and spent some time on the FTC's Truth in Advertising page. And it's pretty steep if she doesn't comply, like ridiculously steep.
Sweet.
If she doesn't yes. So if she doesn't comply and remove all of these claims from any media that promotes or advertises her product, or I guess she says, I'm not selling anything, but you know, she is. So she said that they have to, if she doesn't comply by a certain date, and this is the problem, is she didn't specify in the video what date they had given her to comply. But if she doesn't comply by that date, they will send her a cease and desist letter. And once a cease and desist letter is ordered by the FTC, every single day that she's in violation is a fine of over $41,000 per day.
Ooh, excellent. Deep. That's got to be public record, I would think, that you'd be able to check that out. You know,
So I tried to check the FTC website, and I think because it was issued today, it hadn't been uploaded yet. Because they do have all of their letters, like similar letters have been issued to companies like doTERRA and Young Living when they claimed that essential oils could cure Ebola. So the other thing that can happen too is this, in addition to the fines, she'll also be required to pay back anyone that she made these claims to that purchased her product, which is her books, as well as individuals that, paid to use her website. And in addition to all of that as well, if she still doesn't comply after that, the FTC will force her to create all new media, which basically says that her claims were false. She'll have to notify every single person that tried the protocol that it was false and she misled them.
So if she's ordered to pay back the money that everybody paid to buy her book, that means she's going to have to, I just did the math, she's going to have to wind up giving a total of $3.99 in proper damages.
But why is this happening to her now? I mean, she's been doing this for a long time. She was on Dr. Phil, Jeff Holliday went after her. Why is the FTC all of a sudden taking notice now?
So here's the thing, is Jeff Holliday's appearance on Dr. Phil is what precipitated this whole investigation. So following the Dr. Phil episode, numerous people made complaints to the FTC and the Ohio Attorney General. There's been a coordinated effort on Facebook with an organized group of individuals that are working together to get her shut down. They make calls to the Ohio Attorney General, to the FTC. They contact local media. I mean, these people are ridiculously organized and determined to stop her. And thanks to their efforts following that appearance on Dr. Phil, the FTC and the Ohio Attorney General started an investigation in May. they sent her a letter in May and gave her until, I think it was sometime in August to respond, or maybe it was June, but she got an extension. And I think she provided everything to them by August. And then they just responded today.
Awesome.
Wow. Well, yeah.
And I forgot to say that
coming on.
I forgot to say too, that any of the individuals too, in addition to anything that the government does, they can also file class action lawsuits against her.
Which they probably
That's
will.
Coming. Like, absolutely, that's coming. I might actually file one just for the hell of it.
why not? They don't actually check if you actually drank the shit or not. You just gotta sign your name to the class action.
I mean, she did affect my mental health for quite a few days. Still, actually.
Yeah.
It's a victory. Nonetheless, this is a victory. Good job.
Thank you so much for coming on and catching us up, guys. If you have not already, if you haven't. Follow her on Twitter. Make sure you do that. It's at WOA Crystal Ball. I think I got that right.
Yep, and join the chat. I'll join the chat and post a link to the article with the information too.
And her articles appear on Patheos at Without a Crystal Ball. I can't talk tonight, and they're fantastic. So, thank you very much for what you do and for coming on here and letting us know what that crazy cabbage lady's doing.
Of course. Thanks for having me. Have a good night, guys.
Absolutely.
Bye.
Bye, Katie.
Bye.
Okay. Now we are going to bring on, I'm under a lot of pressure. As people know, I cannot say standard names correctly half the time, but I'm going to give this one a shot and hope that I get it. R.L.
Kyle.
That's good, right? He did it right. Yeah, R.L. I'm the one having a hard time saying it.
What's that, Kyle?
Is it?
Yeah, R.L. Avinu.
Yeah,
Avinu.
Where is this from?
So R.L. Avinu is a Hebrew derivative. It spells out a lovely sentence, which is connected to religion. And maybe we'll talk about that sometime.
I think this might be the time. I'm enthralled with the voice. The voice to me is just like,
I'm digging the tie and vest over there, but since we just bought these t-shirts, you know, this is what you're going to see me in for a while.
That's okay, man. Rock it. Own it. On it. I had to dress up for you. I saw the pictures on the website, and I was like, "Oh well, I have to match the."
I'm feeling so uncomfortable right now. you guys need a room?
Welcome. We're not gonna let Steve make it awkward. But welcome to the show. Thank you for coming
on. Already happened.
It's good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. I first learned about you because I have a really close tie to Aaron, and that is I was a young earth creationist for 25 years. I deconverted from that when I was 25, and part of the reason that happened is because I watched Aaron's videos. I caught a glimpse of one at a youth group one night, and so that was the first time I was exposed to him, and then I just kept watching it, and eventually he was one of the people that kind of broke through that barrier. And so I saw that you did a documentary on Aaron, which was amazing. So I want to kind of dive into that a little bit too, but go ahead and introduce yourself. Tell people who you are, what you do, and why you do what you do.
I'm R.L. Avinu, the founder of Fully Deconverted, an original content and discussion-based platform dedicated to the disenfranchisement of dogma. And what that essentially means is there's no authority on truth except for truth itself. And that truth is what we're able to discover in the environment around us, using methods to give us that empirical data. I started it because I was a Christian trying to have a conversation in a religious community that rejected it. And I was a biblical and theological student also, which added to the frustration. I deconverted a little less than 1 year ago. And here I am now.
Excellent. What made you, let's go through your past a little bit. What denomination were you, first of all? What church did you subscribe to?
You would have recognized me as most closely identifying with Baptist, Southern Baptist, and then I got into the non-denominational. I've been in Catholic Mass, I've been in Methodist, I've been in Lutheran, I've been in Presbyterian, I've been in Pentecostal. So I have tasted the flavors. But at the end of my religious experience, it was non-denominational. You know, the thing that the hip young pastors are doing.
Oh, yeah. And I got to tell you, the cadence of your speech and all that, you would have been a excellent pastor. I can see it now. I can see it. I can see it happening. Yeah. Which flavor did you like the best out of all of the tour, so to speak?
Assemblies of God. Assemblies of God, because this is where you go for entertainment. This is where you get to sit down in the pews and get called out for sitting down in the pews as being possessed by Satan. You see, Assemblies of God is that Pentecostal type that has to get up, and if they're not shouting, waving their hands, and dancing, they are not filled with the Holy Ghost. And if you're not filled with the Holy Ghost, you must be filled with the only other thing left, which is Satan. And I was called out a few times. Nevertheless, was quite entertained.
Okay, so... Have you ever spoken in tongues yourself?
No. I've been prompted to several times.
Excellent. Have you translated anybody's tongues before?
No.
And my last question with the Pentecostal thing, because I love talking to people who were in these churches, because I like our friend the Godless Island, he has a bunch of really great stories. Because he used to actually be a Pentecostal minister, and the healing, or slain in the spirit, as they called it. Were you ever slain in the spirit? Did you ever get touched and fall out on the floor or run around the church?
So when I was a young teenager, I did an altar call at a revival in which I seen 25 persons roughly about go down on the right of me. I was in the middle. It was my turn. They put hands on me, tried to get me to speak in tongues. I was quite impressionable at the time. Tried to speak in tongues, but it all came out in English. They gave up, moved on, but they still tried to have somebody back to slay me in the spirit. After several failed attempts at that, I was asked to close my eyes, relax all my muscles and all my body, and I was pushed to the ground. So I have that experience under my belt.
Sounds like a salt.
Oh, that's excellent.
Yeah, it's a salt, Steve.
I grew up.
My mother was watching at that time. She came up about 15 minutes later when the crowd was kind of, you know, dying down a little bit. And she said that she had watched the Holy Spirit slay me and all that. I had to explain to her it wasn't real. She got mad at me for going down to the ground if it wasn't real. Then I had to explain the assault.
Scientology would call you a suppressive person. We learned that last week. So
I've been in the Scientology headquarters.
You're not clear. Which one?
For what reason? Did you go to Scientology?
No, I didn't. I was freshly deconverted, and I was up in New York City filming some interviews, and I went to their Scientology headquarters there and asked some questions, reviewed some of their material, and they tried to sell me a few books so I could learn more, and I said, hey, without any substance up front, why would I support you commercially? Give me something. They offered another book, and then I walked out.
So you didn't get to meet Xenu. I hear he's quite the gem.
I met an old guy that resembled a priest that you don't want to be in the back alley with after daylight.
I don't want to be in the back alley with any priest.
Or front alley or any other alley. But it reminds me of that. Have you seen the video where there's a Catholic priest and there's a line of kids, and basically the kids go up to the priest and the guy just literally smacks him upside the head, whacks him around, and pushes him to the ground, like one by one? It's like, how is that not abuse? If I was a parent and some kid died, did that to my kid, I'd be decking them. I don't care if he's a clergy or not. It just was obscene.
I remember that video.
Yeah,
absolutely. But Steve, that is exactly the type of environments that exist, where everybody in the pews kind of disassociates the responsibility of reacting to this, because for them, undoubtedly, for such a long time, they're taught that the authority up at top, whatever they decide, whatever they say or do, is incontrovertible. And they probably give the little head nod back and forth and like, nobody doing anything? Well, I'm not going to be the one.
Yeah, right. Well, they acquiesce their moral responsibility to somebody else because they don't want to have first of all, they don't have the courage to stand up, I don't think, but I don't think they even have the ability because, like you said, they defer to somebody else of a higher authority because they've already given over their authority to somebody. And so I'm not surprised that nobody stands up, but at the same time, I am, because if that kind of makes sense.
Well, you know, yeah. Let me tell you, there's a similar thing that happens to you in a movie theater when you go see a movie, like especially when you see a movie that takes place back in the, you know, the 1800s or 1700s about the old South, that head turn to, you know, to see how everybody's reacting. If you're in a movie theater and you're watching one of those movies and there's a white person that says the N-word and you're in a movie theater, that's instantly what all the white people do. In the theater, they stop and they go, all right, is everybody okay with this? Is this happening?
It's like a tribal thing. They look around going, wait a minute, should we be offended? Or, you know, what do we do here?
Right.
Are we also looking for somebody else for a social cue?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to be you don't want to be the only person acting out. Aside from everybody else in whether it's a theater or a church to that point, I grew up as a Southern Baptist first. And then I went to being an independent Baptist. And I had a friend of mine that invited me to a Pentecostal church one Sunday. And I'd never been to one before. And so the service was fine. Music was just like we do at our church. And then the altar call started. And I remember thinking that this is awful early. Like, this is a very early altar call. And there's a reason for that, because the altar call lasts like an hour. And for the next hour, there were people beating tambourines, running up and down the aisles, getting slain all around me. And I had no exposure to this before. And I was scared out of my mind. Like, please do not come over here and put your hands on me, because, of course, I'm going to fall. Mm. I will fold like that. I don't want to seem like I'm resistant. I will fold, but yeah, it's just really strange. So I feel you on that point. I like my quiet Baptist hellfire and brimstone sermons, and then go home and eat, because they try to get out of there very quickly in Baptist time. They want to go home and eat lunch.
See, I like the Black Revival churches. I love the choir and all that. I'd be down for that kind of stuff.
Yep.
I mean, I've enjoyed all of them, except where you go and everybody's 90 years old and they're about to die, and you're the only young person that walks in there, and they want to keep you there. So everybody shakes your hand and says, oh, thank you, young man or lady, for coming in. You know, why don't you meet a few of us? And you're their only hope, right? But you know you're not going back to that.
Yeah. That's so true, though. That is so true. So, what was it that in your faith that started the doubt? Where did you get along to where you something put a crack in the dam, so to speak?
When the promises weren't coming through, or when they weren't consistent, or when you think of a loving God who wishes all would be saved, but you're standing on a mountain somewhere in a foreign country, and these people have no clue. Or you go to another foreign country, and their Abrahamic religion is much more stronger than your own, making you appear as though you're not religious at all. And then you go back to your country, you know, your home country, where God is absolutely true, for certain, above all others. But nobody really cares, and nobody even knows how to talk about it. And then you start asking yourself about your own faith and what distinguishes it from others, only to find out the metric by which you measure the veracity of your own faith-based claims is no different than all other religions. And then from there, it's just doing a little research questions, and you know, the inevitable comes.
So when you say the example of standing on a mountain and the stronger faiths overseas, I assume you were in the military, correct?
I was, yeah.
What did you see over there when you say that it seems their faith is stronger?
So I was in the Middle East. And if you're in the Middle East, especially if you're in Islamic majority country, what you will see is maybe a few times a day, or if you're by a temple, you'll hear a sound go off. In America, the closest thing we have to this is like a weather emergency alarm. We kind of get it on our phones now. But maybe 50 years ago, they'd blast something out so the whole city can hear it. That's about what the equivalent is over there, and that means it's time to pray. Okay, so they take this seriously. And one of their five pillars of faith, if you're a Muslim, is to pray several times a day. I think it's five times a day. And they would do that. And you just see everybody all around the city. I lived in a high-rise flat. You know, you just look down and everybody's going to temple. They have Ramadan. You know, this is approximately a month where they're fasting during the day. They don't drink water or eat food. Despite what our opinions might be of some of their social behavioral practices, given their hadiths, the women do wear the burqas, and the men wear white, the women wear black, and they honor their culture or their religion in doing so. You know, and if you come to America, you just don't get those things unless you're a small group of people that everybody else likes to identify as a cult, simply because you are that distinguished. But I think the false equivocation there is the fact that, no, we're all reformed in our own way. There was a schism at some point where we all just decided whatever went our own way. We were born into that. And in the Middle East, that's them. And it's serious for them.
Very good. Yeah. That's a very good, and that was one question I always had when at the time that I was kind of coming out of religion. One of the questions that got to me was, if I'm this benevolent creator, I fashioned the world, I fashioned everyone in it, and I care about each individual to the point where I know how many hairs are on their heads, that sort of thing. If you have such a, I mean, there are billions, billions, and billions of Muslims. What sense does it make to throw into a pit of fire for eternity a group of people that stop what they're doing five times a day, roll out a mat, no matter what, you know, no matter what's going on that day, no matter what's happening, they're going to make sure that they pray. They make sure that, you know, they're trying to get to Mecca. They do these things because it's commanded of them, whereas over here, kind of like what you said, you know, we might go to church on Sunday if we feel like it, or if we know that Nancy, who likes the gossip, isn't going to be there, or you know what I'm saying, the little things like that that we nitpick over here, it's not an option over there. Like, there's none of that kind of those factors would never come into play over there. So that was one of the things that I had, like, why would you burn three quarters of the creation that you claim to love and know how many hairs are on their head when all they've done is what they think is the correct thing to do, which is stop five times a day and pray. So that it didn't make any sense.
Because they're heavily influenced where they were born.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, yeah. So Steve has a point. I mean, there they are born. That's their culture. That's and there's value there. And that value acts as a commodity for their acceptance within that culture. So whether or not they're truly believers, they will demonstrate as though they have those qualities to remain accepted and to be able to progress through their social hierarchies, you know, whether it's private or commercial. Over there, you're going to see it mixed much more than over here. That's a way of survival for them. I don't mean to take it back to, like, you know, 20,000 years ago, but the principle is still in play today, whether you're over there or over here. Just for them in religion, it's much more pronounced, which might make a visitor there who is naturally inquisitive maybe reflect on their own religion and think, man, am I religious? Because when I see their practice, they're dedicated. But over here in America, you know, I go to my non-denominational, wear whatever I want, be hip, be cool. Premarital sex isn't that big of a deal in a lot of those churches, Southern Independent Fundamental Baptist, maybe. You know, so you can get away with it, still pay your tithe, and still have your good social standing. you know, you can't do that in majority Islamic countries without looking over your shoulder. So Steve has a point. Where you're born and the values that you receive play a big role in your social development.
Yeah, and there's two other major factors, contributing factors. One, Islam is a state religion over there. I mean, so if you do not adhere to the tenets properly, you can go to jail. You can get, you know, fined. You can lose body parts. You are heavily influenced by the fact that you can't have the freedoms you expect to have over here. So that's that's one thing. And the other thing is, over here, like you said, it's more of a cultural Christianity of sorts, right? Over there, it's a way of life. It's not just a religion to them. It is a way of life. And you don't see that here as much, except as you noted, in what we would call a cult, right? So the norm for them is cult for us. So we are, as Americans, and I would even say European as well, we're a lot more mainstream when it comes to the average religious person, because religiosity is nothing compared to what you see over the Arab Emirates and Bahrain, Dubai, Jebel Ali. I've been over
two
there
different
as well.
Worlds.
Two different worlds, absolutely.
When you finally came out of religion, what was that like in terms of, because I assume since you were in it so long and you seemed pretty dedicated to it, that it would be a safe bet that all of your, or most of your relationships would be kind of connected or intertwined into that as well. So what was that like when you finally realized, oh, there's nothing to this, you know, I've been living a lie? How did that go over with not only the people in your family, but your circle of friends, that sort of thing?
Well, first of all, it's somewhat like what you might imagine. It's like getting unplugged from the matrix. You're completely disoriented. And you are scrambling and searching for something to hold on to so that you don't continue to fall down this rabbit hole of the great unknown. You're right, Kyle, in saying that most of my connections were religious connections. That was my family. That was my social support system and structure. That's all my memories. That's where I started my professions. You know, everything is tied to that. So I felt, or rather, what felt like an organic process of deepening my faith in studying theology and posing questions, the hard questions that usually don't ever come up, simply led to a place where I realized I was walking to an edge, or maybe a building top, where you're looking over the edge and you're thinking, what do I do now? Jump? You know, that's crazy.
Right.
And then you realize you have no alternative. And then you do, simply because it seems like there's more answers that direction than what's behind you. And by the way, everybody looks like they're faking it once you progress to that point anyways. You look back and you realize all the masks that everybody wears when they're acting pious, or when they say, oh, I don't want sex. I want to remain pure. No, that's a straight up lie. We all want this. We all want food. We all want shelter. We all want sex. You know, and we want these with varying degrees, but these are basic human needs. And what I began to recognize is there are institutional veils placed over us, that we at some point voluntarily choose not to acknowledge. And that's not my personality. I tend to think that the taboo things are okay to talk about. After all, they're real. And you know, so I jumped off the ledge, and, it was disorienting. I lost a lot of my community, no doubt. But it was also very liberating after a few days. I do still have some friends that I'm very grateful are still hanging out with me. But now I am forging my own community. That is why I created Fully Deconverted. I do have a community there. I have a solid team and people smarter than I in the discussion group that I you know, for 20 years being in Christianity, never thought I would have these conversations. And this is where I landed. I count myself fortunate.
So what made you decide to go into the kind of activism that you do now? What was the trigger point for that?
The trigger point was as a rebuttal for the shutdown on discussion that was happening when I was a Christian asking questions. And I was good friends with a pastor of a local church here where I reside. And, you know, I did filmmaking there. I filmed their conversion stories. So I was a prominent figure. People knew my face. I was involved there for 2 years, gave money, did their live production, and I was their resident videographer. So as I began my journey of asking hard questions, going to this social media platforms, you know, I would get a lot of comments, a lot of people to kind of, don't go there. Don't ask that. You know, you might cause a divide, right? Don't express allegiance to an ideology that is contrary to the core of ours. Because if you do so, we'll have to quietly dismiss you. And this is not okay. Not when you value the relationship over the ideology that someone may hold. By the way, we change those every 5 years on average. So once I did deconvert, I did the thing that I was not allowed to do in my former community. I went independent, started filming my own documentaries, and I gave that back to my religious community so that they could see that I wasn't afraid and that they don't have to be either. And then that evolved into Fully Deconverted. I did it because I was told I couldn't do it.
Good for you. That's the best motive. That's the best motivator, I think. And when
been there, been there, done that. Yeah. Yeah. Does a lot of your congregation ever watch any of your things? I mean, they you know, watch you and ask you questions, or are they still kind of standoffish in some ways?
Some of them have departed fellowship with me. Others have blocked me. Others have come on the journey with me, though they're still a Christian. I don't know if I would say somebody has switched sides because of what I do. But I received more than what I expected in private messages of support for people that you wouldn't have expected, given where they are in the church hierarchy. So, all in all, I counted that as a huge plus, and it restored my faith or trust in the fact that people can exercise common sense despite being in an environment which really produces nothing other than like some sort of cognitive conflict with which people just resign themselves from working out. Yeah, so people have watched, but nobody's came to me, Steve, and said, you know, because of the information you brought up, I've also deconverted. We humans tend to be a little bit more, I don't want to say cowardly, because that seems maligning, but I know what it's like to feel fear and to be cowardly. I get that. I understand that. So it does take somebody weighing the options and being willing to risk, in this case, all out of fear, to be able to say that to somebody else. Hey, you know what? I no longer believe either, despite my 20, 50 years, $100,000 investment. Just doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, you remind me a lot of Paul Agia, because he has a very similar experience. Mm-hmm. And his deconversion.
And a lot of the people that we talk to, Ron Miscavige was saying, the biggest hindrance for people that to come out of Scientology is that very thing, that hesitant to admit they were wrong about something they invested not only so much time, but so much money in the case of Scientology, you know, because they sink untold amount of money to that. And nobody wants to walk away looking like, oh, I just, you know, pissed that away. You know.
Yeah, it's called. There's actually a name for that. It's actually called the sunk cost fallacy. And It's basically you've already invested so much time, then you might as well see it through to the, you know, the end kind of thing. Let's get to that OT level 7 or 8. I've already put in 200,000. What's a few more, couple tens of thousands to get to the next operating level kind of thing? That's exactly what it is.
That's right.
Well, we do it. We do it all the time. We do it with relationships. The sunk cost fallacy all the time. How many times have you been in a relationship? You said, you know, I've already been with her 3 years. You know. So, you know, let's try to work it out. When you know it's not going to work out, right? We've all been there.
Too many.
That.
Yeah, you're exactly right. We do that in all areas of our life, Steve. You're right.
Usually.
So what was it that don't tell him that, RL. We don't have a brain big enough down there to fit his head in if you don't.
Between my ego and his looks, you know, I don't know why we have anybody else on this show. What are we doing here?
Oh, That's quite a call. Thank you, Steve. So what was the first project that you set your sights on?
I guess. I don't know.
Okay, Steve. Look, you look when you do that, leave it at the first comment, because if you keep going with it, it makes
Dave,
it really,
doing,
like,
what is Dave doing to my image here, okay. Dave? You're freaking me out here.
it's pushing it. You know what I'm saying? You just acknowledge it and then move on. If you keep pushing it, then it we're where we are now, where there's just like really awkward.
What's happening?
What's he doing?
This is awkward. What is Dave's doing something in my head?
Oh,
carry on. Oh, I get it. I get it.
See how big it gets before the show's over. I had to pause, Steve. I don't know what's happening. Dave is screwing your window over big time. Good. So, what was your first project that you decided that you were going to do when you started doing Fully Deconverted? What was your goal, and then the first step you took to get to that goal? Like, what was the first thing that you decided that you wanted to cover, talk about, shoot, that sort of thing?
In terms of Fully Deconverted, the first project that we really launched with was our 10-episode series with Arden Raw. And I didn't know anything about the atheist community. I lucked into meeting Arden Raw. I didn't really know a lot about his content, but he seemed, I do interviews. So I asked him for an interview. He said, yeah, we did it. We filmed it. And that was before I was actually public as being a non-believer. So that was, I was launching one of my last documentaries called Reshaping Reality. That's where I came out, in the same story as I tell of another Christian minister who became an atheist. So while waiting for that to air, I filmed Arden Raw, and I knew I needed to go somewhere with this. So after Reshaping Reality aired, I branded Fully Deconverted because I realized that's where I'm at in life. And then I produced the Arden Raw series, and that was meant to be a project where, you know, that was the first big project where people can see the discussion happen. If you watch this series, you can tell I'm newly deconverted, because a lot of my questions might seem devil's advocate, and sure they are, but they're also still questions of mine that I still had, or perhaps still have, and. You know, that's the platform that we started on. I'm a filmmaker by trade. So that is a slice of the pie that Fully Deconverted brings now to the atheist community. Just film, trying to make something produced, artistic, repackage our ideas and our discussions in a more artful presentation. So it can be more entertaining to watch, and it can drive home kind of a more poetic message instead of just being lecture form. And we hope to continue doing this. And we just wrapped our series with Richard Carrier. And we'll be airing that this fall.
Oh, excellent. That's exciting. I don't think you could have picked a better person to start your series with than Arden. Were you still in the faith when that started, or were you, You just weren't out yet? Like you doubted, and you kind of thought that this wasn't true or anything like that. But are we still struggling with it a little bit while talking to him?
I was 95, maybe 99% certain that I could not walk back to the core of Christian claims with any confidence. So I was right at that ledge. And I told Arden that I was no longer a believer, because you can't, with any kind of integrity, say, yo, I'm a Christian believer, and sit there and, you know, really bring up all this controversy. So at that time, looking back, I was deconverted. It was a one-way trip out. There was no going back at that point. I was still a church goer.
Sure.
So after filming that series, which I was marketing, people knew that I filmed a series with Arden Raw, though I doubt many of the people that I knew personally knew the name Arden Raw or even anything about atheist activism. And then I came back, continued to market it, produce it, air Reshaping Reality, still went to church. And the week before Reshaping Reality aired, the pastor said some really dumb things from stage. And I just figured, here's my exit. And I did.
What were the dumb
things? That was like April-ish. The dumb thing was I would host socials here at my house. And, you know, we do karaoke parties. And I was beginning to be seen as a dissenter, someone who asked too many questions and had an opposing ideology developing, which threatened the unity of the culture at that church. Again, I do film. You know, I put things out on social media. People can see it. You can't stop that. You know, so you go behind closed doors and be like, hey, quiet down. You know, hey, let's talk. Let's have a conversation. What's going on with you? You know, and I would just ask that back. What's going on with you? You know, let's approach these topics and be honest about it and what we know and only say what we know. You know, that was the direction I was going. And, you know, so there's that attitude toward me. And then some people left the church, and some people who left that church would come to my parties. Here we are going live all the time, you know, singing and doing karaoke and whatever. And just doing the things that we do. And then one Sunday I'm sitting in the front row. I just come back from filming the R and Raw series, and maybe I travel somewhere else. Anyways, sitting in the front row, and the pastor says, makes an example out of what we did and compares that to people who leave the search and rescue mission to find lost individuals to go and pursue deeper community at a friend's house, singing karaoke, and then go to another church. You know, some people at my house left that church and went to another one, just, you know, because that's what we do, right? We're consumers. We go to wherever we feel best at. And, you know, he made an example of that, and I was furious, absolutely furious, because don't call me out, man. Not when I'm being polite about this on my end. I'm just being honest, you know, and I'm not hurting anybody. You know, I'm putting information out there. But for you to use your platform to condemn such social practices and then equivocate them to the very reason why people are going to hell, you just lost my vote, buddy. You've lost my support as a friend, and I'm out of here. This is abuse.
Did you confront him?
Did you ever fight? Did you?
I confronted him immediately after dismissal of service.
Did you find that there's this narrative in many religions that if you ask too many questions, they label you like a spirit of strife or conflict, somebody that doesn't have the true gifts and fruits of the spirit. Will you ever label something like that? I mean, I know it wasn't like suppressive like you would be in Scientology, but do they say that you, for some reason, were just disconnecting yourself from the Lord and therefore you had this evil spirit of some kind around you or
backslidden?
I hate to use the word evil spirit because I'm, you know, demons, but even that, do they even accuse you of that?
Backslidden.
No, they're too non-denominational to really throw a label on it. That's how non-denominational they are. And unfortunately, I was moving so quickly with all my projects, there was really never time for them to put a finger on my pulse. There was only reactions like, oh no, oh no, you know, and then it just came to that. There might have been discussion behind closed doors, but nobody ever confronted me as though I was backslidden, because probably they knew what I would have said about that. Backslidden about what? I'm asking questions. I'm a biblical and theological student. What is it you're expecting me to be silent about? All of this is relevant.
Sure.
And, you know, maybe they try to imply some sort of dissension or, you know, anarchist attitude or something like that in some very moderate way, when they would respond to me on Facebook when I would, you know, post publicly about some of my thoughts. But then they would wholesale delete their comments because, you know, they didn't want to appear as though they're not smart enough to actually answer these questions. And they don't want the public to peruse these forums to see questions asked, but only to see pastors and leaders in the church, you know, throw their hands up and be like, don't know what to make of this. Don't know how to answer it. Maybe there are no answers. And then other people thinking exactly the same thing, thereby losing their reason to donate their money to the church or to attend or to serve. After all, if religion has no answers, what are we doing here?
Very well said. Very well said. Well, I gotta say though, it's not all that surprising that you wound up here based on some of the things that you said about your past, because it seems like you've always been kind of inquisitive or curious. When I asked you about the Pentecostal churches and how they tried to, you know, coerce you into speaking in tongues, a lot of times, from what I see, the people just go along with it. You know, they, like me, they would have folded, you know, like a wet brown bag and just spouted some bullshit out of their mouth and rambled, clucking like a chicken. But
I've seen that.
It seems like you, that wasn't the case with you. You were always questioning, like, okay, either is this the way that it should be, or inclination to just fold and go with the crowd. So I don't think it's surprising that you wound up where you are today.
Whenever it came to something as serious as something I believed we should put, you know, our hopes, thoughts, prayers, future dreams, eternal life on the line for, you know, is and of course being somewhat indoctrinated in it, I just assumed it's true. And if it's true, we don't have to act like it's fake. But then why are we? So I always approach things absolutely thinking, oh, speaking in tongues, this is a gift from the Holy Spirit. Let me go up and receive it. Only it didn't happen. Oh, getting slain in the Spirit. Man, I can't wait for this. You know, guy pushes me down. And now I have to do all the explaining, you know, of why I wasn't good enough to have received these things.
You didn't, when you were asked about it, you didn't try to spin it like you actually, you know, you acknowledged that that it wasn't that you had gotten kind of filled with the Holy Spirit. I think that says a lot about your character as well. Going back to there was one thing that I wrote down. Let me see my notes here. When you were talking to Arn and the questions that you were asking him, I'm going to ask a question for Steve right now and see kind of where you fell. Logically speaking, what did you feel about evolution and creation when you were actually in the faith? Were you a young earth creationist, or were you Steve, the term escapes me. Oh, man.
Younger creationist? Lion evolutionary theist? I would probably place myself as that. I was never a young earth creationist. The closest I ever came was that I thought, obviously, Adam and Eve, but I didn't know how far back it went, but I never bought into the Noah story. I never thought that, 7.7 million extant, you know, species of animals, you know, came from an ark, the size of, a football field or something. That's just was unimaginable to me. But I know a lot more now than I did when I was a theist back then, even though I wasn't an idiot back then. So I didn't think any of those things, but I would probably place myself as an evolutionary theist that didn't know how it all worked, but I accepted evolution since I was like fifth grade.
Sure.
I progressed. I started at the 6,000 years. That's what you get told in conservative fundamental Christianity, which is my roots, and progressed as I progressed through the denominations. Imagine that. Whatever church I went to, whatever they're saying, I'm thinking, oh, this sounds like the next big thing that we have learned or that theologians have uncovered or discovered. And I was happy to start seeing religious beliefs and ideologies and theology align with modern science. But, you know, of course, you always see that happen, but with the disclaimer that the Bible is the ultimate authority, which we reference in empirical science that is used to support those things in the Bible, which it corroborates. But otherwise, empiricism isn't actually a high value doctrine, and our dogma is the highest value first. So we always reference that. Started off 6,000 years, then a evolutionary creationist, you know, all this stuff. And then you just start realizing as you're getting older, this doesn't make sense, you know, how this chasm can exist. And, you know, I didn't actually pay much attention to that as someone who investigated that so much as I did just observing and investigating people's behaviors. I'm more of the psychologist who wants to observe the way you're reacting. And, you know, when you start speaking in tongues for the first time or get slain in the spirit, I'm watching every movement you make. Because if it appears as though you were doing this, then we have to ask the question, okay, if it's not authentic here, let's go back further and find out when it is authentic. And then when we do that and start studying history, all we're seeing there is the same thing that we see when somebody reacts and pretends to speak in tongues and getting slain in spirit. They're not being taken over by any external force. They're simply dealing with the situation they've been dealt. And those are the things that I would study. Never the science. So I never tried to form my own case about 6,000 years or evolution. You know, I defer to the experts on that at present.
You know, I do believe this. I believe that young earth creation mixed with intelligence equals atheism. So as what I mean by that is if you're a young earth creationist and you start getting smarter, you're more likely to leave it all together. And it's kind of funny because people that leave a general church, like let's say you're Sunday school Christians, you know, they don't really just fall away. They just go because it's a social thing, right? But younger creationists, I've noticed this. They, for some reason, when they lose their when they realize that it's all bullshit for as far as the younger creationist aspect, they lose their faith completely, except for one case. I don't even know one person. He now is a theistic evolutionist. But every other young creationist that I've known that has realized that that younger creationist is wrong, that they imply that to their faith as well. And so it's one of those things as more you learn and the more you go to college and the more you study these things, and you find out that the younger creationist position is completely untenable, it converts people away from religion. And I should say it converts people to atheism or agnosticism, to be fair.
So. Yeah.
There's a big reason for that. And that's because once that particular part of the book is deemed, you know, incorrect, false, not true, and you've been told your entire life that it's, you know, the inspired word of God, then there's no reason to, you know, to think that the rest of it is the same thing. You know, like stuff starts falling into place at that time, or at least it did with me. Once one thing goes down in that book, and that's the problem with, or not the problem, I guess, it's a two-edged sword, but when you're, there are people who are theists that from the onset square science and the Bible. They grasp the fact that the Bible is allegory, and they march on in their faith from that point. So it's not an issue because the Bible is just stories meant to tell a deeper meaning. However, when you are from the fundamental aspect of it and you are told that this is the unshakable, unfalsifiable word of God, and then something is demonstrably incorrect with that, it nulls the entire book. So that's where you have that kind of problem, I think. And in the case of people coming out of it, it's a good thing. For religion, it's a bad thing.
Yeah, that you know, that kind of cognitive dissonance that happens to people who are truly inquisitive and not afraid to take that intellectual journey of observation, that's what is so disorienting about the whole deconversion experience. And in fact, I imagine there's so many people that are held back simply for the fear that that process invokes, and they don't take those steps. And this is why we get the private messages of support and not the, hey, I'm going to come to your house. I'll support you in what you do openly. You know, we don't get that. Instead, the people with dissonance are dealing with that, and they hang back. And I respect that because I went through that. I know how afraid I was in that moment. I was absolutely afraid. Even my friends that are still my friends now, you know, I kind of distanced myself from everybody because I wasn't sure what values you have once you stop being a Christian. Like, you know, because you hear the discussions on objective morality. And then when you come out, you're like, wait a minute, if there's no God telling me what to do, and then you've seen the meme, right? Whose slave will I be then? If I don't have a master coordinating my life, how all of a sudden am I able to responsibly take upon the burden of living my life and having my own values? You know, and then you just go down that alley. But what you realize is, oh, wait a minute, everything's good because as humans, you know, we've worked this out. We just do for community. This is communal values, social values, this whole thing. You know, the thing we've been doing all along, even when we abuse it with things like abusive religion, you know, but the principle remains. These are community and social values. You reorient but the cognitive dissonance, that is a scary experience for those approaching the deconversion experience.
Absolutely. And to answer your question, I would choose to be Channing Tatum's slave, just for the record. there's another thing too that I think it's important to point out, and that is that I think that people naturally are curious, and they by their very instinct try to question everything. Religion throws a failsafe in there to block that by saying that that doubting or questioning is a way to realize your eternal soul. And they even tell you that faith is the evidence of things unseen, which if you think about it, it is such a statement because it has the word evidence in there. And faith is the composite of evidence. It has nothing to do with evidence. It's the thing that you don't have evidence and you want to continue to believe something. So the fact that they're saying that evidence is kind of comical, but they try to natural desire to find out. That's where I think for a long time before if we didn't have the internet, I think that the world would be such a dramatically different place. It would be the information is such a powerful thing, and the ability to kind of pull it up on demand and answer questions that you have, I think, has been to the thankfully of things like Scientology or those really kind of harmful. Anybody that can believe a galactic warlord named Xenu took us from a planet billions of years ago, was in a volcano. We exploded into the Satan's exploded into what was it, Steve? The soul?
He basically he took all the whatever they were, I guess, species or whatever, they put them in a volcano, then blew them up. Well, actually, he transported them with DC-10s to a volcano, then blew them up with atomic bombs, and so all those aliens are floating around as Stevens, and now they're attaching people because they want to live again, so they're attaching them to you, and you have to go get clear by not having the Thetans attached to you. Now, you know, it's funny, you say that it's hard to believe that people believe into this, like Xenu, but actually, if you really think about it, when you start getting into churches like the Scientology Church, it's incremental. And it's just one precept upon precept upon precept. And once they've got you so much, after that, it's not that big a pill to swallow after that point, I don't think.
No. Yeah. That's a different kind of stupid, I think.
They prey on stupid.
Here's why. No, it's not like the Bible that has been passed down for thousands of years through our history. This is a guy, Ron Hubbard, who is a science fiction writer who wrote this story. Like, he came up with this story. If you can't see through the lines of a science fiction writer creating a religion that centers around an alien that dropped,
it was a history. It was a documentary. People. Remember, he's just recording events that have already happened. He was just a historian, according to them.
I lose faith in humanity every day here. Every day.
You know, I can appreciate the fact that somebody tried to do that and start Scientology and that sort of thing. But you do face a unique challenge today. Like you've commented on, Kyle, you know, we have data. We're in a dataist age. We have information at our fingertips. And if you look at human history, political history, economic history, you know, going back 2000 years, you see these big shifts instances of decentralizing power. You know, it used to be once upon a time in human history that the person who had all the power, we would have called that person a king. And then we had a shift happen in economics where trade routes allowed for traders and merchants to make a lot of money. And technology was so at the time where that could be done. And then you start having kind of like this middle class forming. This hasn't been done before. So then what happens as a result of that is what we know today, or what we call today as, you know, policies and this sort of thing, you know, checks and balances, that sort of stuff starts forming. You know, we start looking out for the little man because after all, the little man has money. And money's where it's at, right? What are our basic human needs again? Those resources, the thing that gets us food, shelter, and sex. Those are going to be your driving motivators in those moments of change. So you had decentralized power at that. And then let's look at religion. But Catholicism ruled the day until about 500 years ago. 500 years ago, we have what the Reformations, right? Catholicism ruled it for over 1,000 years. And then what happened 500 years ago, or in the 1500s or 1400s? The printing press. Today we have the internet. Back then it was the printing press. And then all of a sudden you get Erasmus, Martin Luther, John Wycliffe. You have all these people come up and start saying, you know, there's some things in Catholicism that just don't sound right. And then you had some of those kind of reformed. Yeah, like everything, right? And then you have some of those reformed ideologies that some chose to stay in Catholicism because, you know, people want to better their own communities, and some who said, you know what, this is all wrong, or it's significantly wrong, and we need a break, and we need to go over here and do something else. Now, you take the Reformation, you know, the data power that they had, the ability to translate and distribute the things that for them carried the most value and weight, and still yet, they didn't understand that the process in which they found themselves was inherently flawed to the core. Sure, you're reforming something, but you're just smacking a new label on it. Why not go to the core? That's how powerful these ideas are. And then today, Kyle, we have the internet, like you said. So if we were to think about the future of atheism or the future of religion, it might go something like this. You're just going to see a continual decentralizing of power in these religious orders. And then if religion isn't so polarizing, then is atheism polarizing? They start coming to this middle, moderate ground. And that's where they meet each other. You don't need revolutionaries on either side. Once everybody already understands, you know, there's just not much to this in the end after all.
Do you know what's going to bring us all together? Alien invasion or zombie apocalypse?
There you go.
Definitely the zombies.
An alien zombie apocalypse would bring us together in some way.
The issue is, though, that they've got all kind of data to support. And I've been touching on this lightly. I've got a video coming out next week that dives into it deeper. But millennials, especially, they did a study on millennials. And because this is the generation that's coming up that is non-religions are at an all-time high, very low numbers in terms of those who identify as religious in the millennials. What they're seeing with that, though, is that religion is being replaced with something harmful or crazy. Like, for example, the flat earth, the rise in the people who believe in flat earth, the rise in people who are anti-vaxxers, the rise in people who buy into stuff such as chili juice, the miracle mineral solution. And reading that study is fascinating because astrology especially is at, an all-time high. That's just increased untold amounts of numbers. And so what people are doing is they're shifting that hole in them, I guess, if you had to paint a picture. People have a hole in them, and we fill that hole with something, whether it be religion, or some kind of different set of beliefs, conspiracies, pseudoscience. And so the question that the article was posing was, in terms of a broad picture, which is more harmful? Are we doing more harm by letting people think that there's a magical guy in the sky, or is it more harmful to believe that not vaccinating your kids is okay because it leads to autism, or that you know, drinking this salt, this cabbage juice is a way to kind of cleanse yourself and regrow limbs? So what would your answer be to that question?
Okay, so religion starts going away, and then in its place comes pseudoscience and other ideologies that still aren't yet evidently true. You could say, well, is it the absence of religion that is bringing these things in? Well, I don't know. But certainly the common denominator there is us. You know, we're wanting something. And if education isn't there, if knowledge and data isn't there, then we're probably going to jump on whatever bandwagon is going in front of our face. So I would say less emphasis on the fact that there are trends and fads, and more emphasis on the fact that, yes, we are searching for meaning. We are searching for community. We are searching for relief. We are searching for comfort. And if we feel like any of those are being violated, or we have the risk of losing them, we are going to reach out into the plethora of ideas and see if there's something there that will add benefit. And if we're not, if it's not accessible, that there is education there, or a learning environment, then we're left with our options. You walk into a room, Kyle, and you've got three persons that are not attractive to you, but one of them is the most attractive. Who are you going to pick? The most attractive person.
Oh, I'm going to go with the ugliest one every time, because I guarantee the ugliest one is going to be more desperate and I have a chance. So there you go. This is me, you know.
No, Steve.
But you know, it's funny you mentioned like the internet. Way back when, and I'm obviously a little bit older than you guys, we couldn't test these claims. I'm like a fine wine. Okay, so back then, when I would read a book or I would hear something, like, for example, I always bring up like Eric von Däniken's In Search of Ancient Astronauts or Chariots of the Gods, I had no way to corroborate anything that was in there. And I kind of just took it at face value. And I was a young kid. I mean, like, I was not even probably a teen when I first read those books, like 12 or something. But we had to go to things, and I know this is going to sound crazy, but we had to go to these big buildings. They were called libraries. And they had these weird things that were called books. Yeah, I'm not lying. They had these things that were made out of this paper, and then you had these bindings, and they had words written on them. And so, you know, it was very difficult to go do research with books that nowadays, as you pointed out astutely, we have it at our fingertips. And yet I see even now people don't access that kind of stuff. They're dumbing themselves down even at a grading level, because maybe it's having a reverse effect, because when you did want to go research something at a library, you know what you were looking for. You had to be dedicated. You had to go to that card catalog. You had to dive into those books. Now I think people take it for granted. And plus, when you go on the internet, a lot of shit out there is not true on the internet. I know it's hard to believe. There's no rule on the internet that it has to be true, unfortunately. And so I think they get a lot of mixture of bad information and good information. If they don't have that skill set to how to discern between the two and how to do proper research, maybe that's even why the case that we have information at our fingertips, it's not being utilized properly, and we're seeing just as many idiots as we did when I was a kid.
Yeah, well, Steve, we have this advance in technology that has happened so quickly that maybe we haven't developed a strong culture on how to be responsible when it comes to that kind of data or information exchange on the internet. And maybe a good example of this is just marketing. When Steve decides to go and look on his phone for, you know, something is going to grab his attention. Whatever is competing for Steve's attention the most probably, or has the highest probability of being clicked on by you. Hey, you're going to check it out. You might become distracted. It might not even be the thing you're looking for. And then you do this enough over time where you have really the people who are marketing the best. They're the people who are feeding all the information. What are some popular, is BuzzFeed legitimate?
Just say Andrew Rappaport.
Yeah, you know, so you'll have these pseudo, you know, news sites and that sort of thing, and you know, they're competing and they're doing well and they have less standards, so they can have looser ethics, and don't we all market to some degree? And you know, we know what grabs attention, and at the end of the day, if you just don't have an audience, well, you don't have a message.
Very well said. And guys, when you are searching for answers on the internet, just a quick tip, to put in your, like Steve was saying, your critical thinking tool set, always remember that the first result is always the true result. That is science. And when you ask Google a question, the first result of
Quora is always true. Right. Well, you know, I think the other problem is that when people go look something on the internet, they never make it past Pornhub. It's like whatever they put in Google, oh, Pornhub.
I know,
I'm done. And you're like, oh, you don't have a good sleep.
Oddly enough, you can answer all of life's mysteries on Pornhub. This is true. I have done extensive research.
There you go. You can study anything you want there.
So I would say, I would venture to say that you don't believe, based on your answers, that the Earth is in fact flat, or that
oh, just say it is. Please tell us you believe it is. Just
that
say
would be a
flat Earth.
Are you a flat
Earth? That would be what a twist.
All right, this is what I don't get. I don't get why you guys don't believe it's flat.
Yeah, see, you know what? I'm with you.
Wow,
I don't
I
get
it
either.
That.
Yeah, you know, Kyle believes that we never went to the moon, so I don't know. Why not, right?
Yeah,
by the way, I'm just joking, guys.
Sorry, Jarenism.
It's NASA. We're actually, the reason why we don't, we actually do, but don't tell anybody. Dave, cut the mics for a second. We're actually NASA.
Yeah, don't listen
students.
Outside.
We get a check from NASA every single month to do this. We come on here and we harp about how NASA's great and that they have all this science and blah 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 blah. But people don't know that. So
yeah, and you know, right, and Kent Hovind CPA gives us a dollar every episode he likes. So every episode you can go back and look at our super chats. Kent Hovind CPA $1. He gave us $2 one time. He really liked that episode. Yeah. Don't remember what it was, but he really liked that episode. That's the best
that
troll account I've ever seen. Kent Hovind's
CPA. I would not want to be Kent Hovind's CPA. He has to get caught up in that.
That is amazing. You guys make me want to troll when you bring up stuff like that.
It's so much fun.
We have the best trolls. Some good trolls.
Yeah. I officially left the need to believe in anything when I deconverted from religion. Yeah.
Do you believe in love?
No, I don't. No.
Do you believe in life after life? I would sing that in the Cher thing, but I can't.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, this is interesting. You believe it's nonsensical?
You believe love is nonsensical?
The question.
Mm.
Yeah. Do you believe in love? Is to me like asking, do you believe in the color blue? I just don't approach my observation of blue in the form of a question. I approach it in the form of an observation.
That's a very appropriate question here because when somebody asks on this show, do you believe in the color blue, it actually sparks a very heated debate between Steve and I. This is an ongoing thing that we have had since day one.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's true.
Yes,
no, he's not even kidding.
Blue. Steve does not believe in the color blue.
I don't believe colors exist. I'm a color realist.
That is amazing. I've always wanted to. There's a guy in my discussion group that sometimes speaks about this topic, but we've never gone into it. Yeah, you know, I'm fascinated by the conversation only report. Yeah.
What were you gonna say? You can only report what?
I can only report what seems to be consistently agreed upon by myself and others. And if that's the thing we call blue, I'm okay with that. And find no cause to venture down the road of atheism or activism, on that matter.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, I'll convince him, trust me.
Steve, you're coming on our show. So we can talk about it then.
Yeah, exactly. You know what? Save that for our dialogue when, you know, we have a higher level
of
conversation.
Don't do it.
Oh, well, I got a lot to talk about.
That'll be a topic we'll bring up.
We're going to have a fun show because I have a lot to talk about. Trust me.
Nice.
What were some of the questions that you said that, and I guess we'll close out with this question and then see if anybody in the live chat has any questions. But what were some of the questions that you had for Arn, for people who haven't seen the documentary? Give them a taste, because you said that these were questions that you yourself had as somebody who was newly coming out of the faith, the devil's advocate thing. What was the most important question that you had that you wanted him to answer for you?
The most important question. You'll hear me say a lot of questions that stereotypically or generally we see Christians say to atheists. Oh, you just hate Christians. You were never a true Christian. You know, questions like that, that I've heard all my life when people make reference to atheists. So I asked them all those questions. I can't say that one in particular stood out to me. I mean, there was a point when I was just firing them at him. And Arn, in his casual but confident stride of throwing back his responses, you know, just did it so well. And you can kind of see my head, you know, because I got the over the shoulder. And I'm just, And he's like, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, all right, what do I do now?
Blah, 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 blah. We've had those kind of conversations so, here many times.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I mean, I asked him it was a 2-hour conversation. There's still one episode that I didn't air that I'll put out there. It's an 11th episode. I'll publish it sometime. But you'll hear all the regular stuff, but you'll also hear my brand of questioning. And my brand of questioning is meant to feel out the person's position. Maybe rather than just play off of what otherwise is the public dialogue. And I do that for my own reasoning, because I want to see how consistent they are with their position. My previous background is law enforcement. So I would do criminal investigations, where the first thing you do is get comfortable with people. You know, you ask them all these questions and you're their friend. We call this the interview portion of the interrogation. And then halfway through, you flip it. You use all the information they gave you and you turn it on them. And you do that at the point where you feel like you have enough inconsistencies to form a credible alternate narrative. And you pose that back in the form of an interrogation. And what you've just created is now a narrative that your suspect has to explain away. And they often can't. Not if you're a good interrogator, they can't. And then you take that to the prosecutor and say, you know, these are the things that they're inconsistent about. So, you know, this is what we call lies. And, you know, and then, you know, they have a very hard time defending themselves in court thereafter. So you'll hear that brand of questioning me to Arn Ra, and then you'll hear all the, you know, the hip fire responses, the things that we all asked or hear asked from theists. Or what we thought when we were former theists.
So basically what you're saying is when you're interviewing people, people just need to take the fifth and not say anything.
Steve, man, let me tell you, if police officers or any type of law enforcement asks you to come in to answer a few of their questions and you are a possible suspect, the thing that you need to say is
stay silent. I want a lawyer.
Actually,
I watch all that stuff. I'm a big fan. What's that?
Not the first question. Am I being detained? Is the first question.
And I mean, am I being detained? What law have I broken?
Of course, you'll know if you're being detained.
Well, no. You know what's funny is obviously cops can lie. Cops can lie to you. But that's the problem. Cops can't lie to you. The Supreme Court has said that, right? So even if you ask, you know, am I being detained? They legally can't say they're being detained unless they have suspicion of a crime, but they lie anyways. And then they ask for ID and they say, well, I don't need, in some states. And it's like, I don't need a reasonable suspicion to ask for ID. That's true, but you don't have to show it to them unless they have reasonable suspicion. You can say, no, I don't want to show it to you. But they're like, you need to. And you're like, you're lying to me. Shut the hell up. And they really press that
videos
narrative.
Ever.
I love those videos. Kyle and I have binge watched so many of them. It's ridiculous.
I've seen everyone on YouTube. I swear I've seen everyone on YouTube.
They're very fascinating for me to watch as well.
Oh, you have watched them? The First Amendment Auditors?
The First Amendment Auditors? No. I don't know that. It's a channel. No, I haven't watched that.
Well, no, it's they're not group. Actually sovereign citizens. It's a group. The First Amendment Auditors, what they will do is they will go to a public venue, such as, a police station. Yeah, like, for example, police station. They go inside the foyer of a police station, and they'll film. They'll film the trophies. They'll film the signage, which is a public viewing area. And the law is that anywhere you can see from a public facility inside the public foyer, the open community area, is filmable. And so these cops will come out or whatever, and they say, you know, you can't film here. And they'll audit them to see if they know the law. And they are interesting to watch, except when – a couple things. One, people have gotten too belligerent. I don't like that. I don't think you need to be belligerent to be First Amendment auditor. And second, you know, these people get arrested a lot. Yep. But you know what? They've also won a lot of civil lawsuits with these cops. They've actually sued. Mm-hmm. And they've won because their rights were violated. They've had illegal search and seizure. They've had assault charges from the police. I mean, they go after them. And I'm wondering how many people do that just so they can sue, as opposed to how many really want to know if the police know
all of them.
The actual. Yeah, it might be true.
Little side gig there.
Yeah, well, here's the thing with that, though. Here's why I say that. Because the videos that they post, there will be a couple of them with what they call a passable audit, which is they showed up. The police didn't say anything. They left them alone, let them film. Those are boring videos, though. They don't want that. They want the confrontations. Those are the videos that get the views. Those are the videos that get watched. Nobody wants to sit and watch a 13-minute long video of somebody walking around a police headquarters foyer. I mean, it's just not good.
We want to see them get shot. Come on, admit it. You want to see them get shot. Maybe leg. The flesh wound. But come on, we're sick people in this society. Come on.
We'll open it up now, guys, to any questions that you have. And once we get those out of the way, I will. I have one question that in listening to your story, that it's a tough question, but I feel it's a fair question. And we'll wrap up with that. But before we get to that, we'll see if the audience has anything they'd like to ask of you. So, Steve, would you please read any super chats or any questions that you've been fielding?
Yeah, a couple of super chats. We got Trevon Hudson, $10. Wolverine is back from the dead in the comics. Oh, really? Okay.
What?
So what does that mean? Wait a minute. He's dead. They killed him. Forget it. He's gone.
So random.
Get over it. Okay? Get the
fuck
over it.
If I saw it in the movies, then he's dead.
It's canon. It was in the movies. Done. Can't no time travel crap for that, okay? Good Lord. Stephen Bauman, $5. Steve, your analysis was correct. Have some booze. Thank you. I don't know what it is. These guys pay me. Whenever I get something right, they give me money for alcohol. What a bad gig is that?
Yeah, there you go.
I'll tell you why that is later, Steve.
Unfortunately, I can't really drink that much. I got one beer sitting in the fridge waiting for a special occasion right now, but I will use that to get something eventually. But anyways, that's the only two super chats. So you've got questions in the live chat. Have at it. Hannah says, Wolverine will never be dead.
Is this a big thing happening with Wolverine? I feel like this is...
They killed him. I mean, why bring him back? That was a good movie.
I really enjoyed that they did that.
Wasn't it good? Didn't they give him a good send-off?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think that's the first superhero movie that I really watched. And like, oh, they killed him, and that's it. And the Superman thing where, you know, the pebbles come up at the very last, microsecond. You know, like, he looked dead.
Yeah, I don't know. The whole super thing. I mean, Superman.
I'm going to go ahead and ask this question and see if we wait on any – because we do have a little bit of a delay being live. There's a like a 30-second delay. And so you can go ahead and answer this question. Now, it's, like I said, I think it's a tough question, but I think it's a fair question. And I want to see how you respond to this. Based on something that you mentioned earlier in your story, what is the greatest karaoke song to sing?
Let me see. I can tell you Meatloaf is really fun to sing. One of my friend and I, we love singing that together. Because if you don't know, Meatloaf is that...
Which song? Paradise by the Dashboard Lights? Anything for Love? Oh,
yeah, so we don't have... Absolutely. Yeah, I would... So Paradise by the Dashboard Lights, like, I love that song, but we don't have it on karaoke. Oh, yeah. We got... I'll Do Anything for Love, and we got one more. I can't remember what that is, but I'd never sing it. It might be Bad Out of Hell.
There you go.
There you go. Oh, yeah. The voice is behind the curtain.
Amazing. David.
It is. It's really fun to sing. But my personal favorite, at least right now, is Creep by Radiohead.
Yeah, Creep's good.
Song.
Yeah. Good song. It is. I love it because...
I bet you better the voice for that, too, don't you? It's
all of us. You know,
I can hit that one better than I can hit some other ones.
Have you ever tried, like, Disturbed? Try some Disturbed.
I'll look into it.
There's a band that does a really good version of Creep called Postmodern Jukebox. They tend to make things more 20s and 30s and 40s.
Oh, they're awesome. I love they're very retro.
Yeah, they do retro covers. They do retro covers of modern songs. So their rendition of Creep it blows it out of the water. It's really cool.
Now, is this a song that you did with your church group? Did you sing? I don't imagine you would sing Creep with the Christian folk around that it seems like that would go too well together.
Kyle, you should know this. If you're going to a karaoke party at a person's house, you're not going there to sing these churchy songs, even though you might sing one or two, because honestly, some of them are beautiful. You're going there to sing Peaches and Cream. Okay.
Oh Lord. Oh, yes. You're going way back.
My kind of church.
Do some Simon and Garfunkel, or some Bread or something, you know? By the way, Bread, highly rated, underrated group.
Baby Got Back on page 46.
I like Big Blood Second, I Lie. How about that? Get some Mix-a-Lot.
What did you say, Steve? Yeah. All right, did anybody have anything on your end?
It doesn't appear so. Let me kind of scroll back here. No, they're good to go.
You guys never ask any questions of anybody really that we have on here.
Yeah, don't take it personally. They really don't. Live chat.
Yeah.
They have their own conversations in live chat. Half the time they don't even listen. They're just talking about completely irrelevant things in live chat. No, I'm kidding.
I noticed that the other day when we had a debate on abortion, and there was a completely different debate going on in the live chat. It had nothing to do with what was it about? I can't even remember now, Steve. But
same thing happens on my channel. No,
yeah, nobody is. Yeah, gotta love them though. Good group. Good group. Couldn't do it without you guys. Yeah. But yeah, I want to say a big thank you for coming on here and being a part. This was a lot of fun, and I enjoyed the
really talk, a lot of fun.
Definitely. And I'm gonna let you kind of sum up absolutely. Any last minute thoughts that you have, or plug your channel, what you've got coming up, that sort of thing.
Okay, if anybody wants to check out Fully Deconverted, you can head over to fullydeconverted.com. You'll find all our social sites on there, and we are currently in the post-production phase of our Richard Carrier series, which is going to be another 10-episode series. It might be more. I mean, it might push 12 or 14. But in any case, and we still have an open GoFundMe on that. There's still some post-production costs. We're right now at just under $2,000. So if anybody wants to throw $5 over there, you're invited to do so if you want. Other than that, though, I look forward to presenting that back over to the public space so people can have that great content again. Kyle, Steve, David, you guys have been great.
Guys, can we keep you forever?
Have you ever been an asshole in your life? I mean, just once. I mean, I'm trying to picture what it would be.
I don't believe it.
Are you always this like it. Nice? Yeah, I don't believe it. Nobody is this nice all the time. You didn't even raise your voice. You didn't use a pejorative. You didn't use an invective. What's wrong with you?
The control over the voice is what I am just astounded at. It's just the cadence and there's been two people that I've watched that have like a really remarkable cadence to them. And the one was tonight, and then the other would be George Carlin. I think George Carlin had the single greatest mastery over not only words and painting a picture with the sentences that he would do. I mean, it was just beautiful the way that he would not only tell jokes, but just talk. And he was brilliant. So I admire people that have that kind of control. I don't, obviously. With this accent, I can't. Even if I had the control, nobody, I couldn't pull it off. Nobody would believe it. So,
but we do have a date on the 15th, do we not? You and I.
Yeah, we do, Steve. You and I.
Awesome. We got a date. We got hear the people
and date. And send me the link to the GoFundMe, and we'll link it in the video as well. And that way, people can
kind of you. Thank you.
Click on it there. Sure. Yeah. All right, guys. Let me just announce that tomorrow is the big day. Finally, after probably about 6 months of me battling this group of people, they are finally coming tomorrow after three cancellations. Usually it happens 3 days before. In the past, they've canceled every time 3 days before. They haven't canceled yet. So I think this is the one. I stress that I would not be rescheduling this if they chose to cancel this one. So tomorrow, Soulphone will be here. Now, we have talked this up majorly. For those of you who don't know, Soulphone is four PhDs that have gotten together and created this technology. I'll use that very loosely, in which you can communicate with people that have passed on into the afterlife. So the four methods of communication are the soul switch, which is a yes or no kind of communication. You ask questions to whichever dearly departed person that you're trying to contact. You will get yes or no answers. Soul keyboard is a one where you like text your loved ones that have passed on. Soul phone is just what it sounds like. They claim that you can actually have a conversation with those that have passed on. And then soul video, which is coming soon. The reason that they canceled last time is because they had major strides in the research and development for this. But it's basically like Skyping heaven or hell, depending on how, you know, your person was in a past life. But supposedly you can have a video call with people who have passed on. Now, I am looking forward to showcasing what dishonest and despicable this whole thing is, to prey on people's depression, their fear, and their grief. I think it's just despicable. So,
am I going to be the good cop, or the bad cop, or going to be both?
Soulphone, if you're watching, I'm totally kidding. We're going to promote Soulphone like crazy. We're going to make sure that everybody has one in their house. This is just, you know, for dramatic purposes. So don't mind what I just said right there if you're listening. But that will be tomorrow at 8 p.m. Eastern. So make sure that you join us for that. And then real quickly, Sunday, we're going to have a discussion on this is a last-minute addition. Lysandrine's wife actually is heavily involved in this project. And what's going on in New Zealand, they introduced a possum over in the country in the 70s, I believe, from what I've seen. This population has gotten out of control. So as in a response to that, the problem that they created, they're dropping these poisonous pellets called 1080. And not only is it killing the possum, but other animals, dogs, cats, anything in the woods. And one child has gotten a hold of these pellets because they just drop them and they're just laying around for things to
eat. Yeah, it's bizarre, isn't it?
So, yeah, it's very bizarre, and it's disgusting. It's a horrible – I don't know, to be honest with you guys, the one thing that – I can take pretty much anything. You've seen me sit through flat earthers and people who don't believe in viruses, people who think that dinosaur fossils are fake and barely flinch. this will bother me. This will affect me like majorly. I don't deal well with any kind of animal cruelty. I have to turn the Sarah McLachlan commercials when they come on TV. I like dive for the remote to change the channel. Like I can't even listen to that song anymore without associating it with that. But I feel it's important that we talk about this. And so I've got somebody from New Zealand actually that works closely with people that are trying to prevent that from happening. So they're going to be here on Sunday. Steve is actually having a debate.
It's called sodium fluoroacetate. If people want to know what we're talking about, go look it up. It's nasty stuff. 1080 or sort of. Yeah. Sodium fluoroacetate.
Yeah. Steve is having a debate on Monday with John Perry on is DNA a code. So make sure that you tune in for that. David Pakman will be here on the 16th to discuss the death penalty. And then last but not least, our favorite porn star will be back the following day on the 17th. Everybody loved Mercedes. The first time she was around, she was fantastic, and we're going to bring her back. This was during the copyright strike, so we didn't actually do this show live. You guys had to watch it. You guys essentially got – would that be sloppy seconds, Steve?
Yeah, and you know what's funny is it's still our highest, I think, for the month, or it's one of our highest rated for the month, and it wasn't even live. So can you imagine what's going to be live for her? So,
yeah.
She's you guys awesome.
So bring your questions. She was so much fun and brilliant. Like when I say brilliant, I don't mean just in her work, because I did extensive research on her in her work. I wanted to make sure that I really knew her as a
the inside and out of her,
so that I could I did extensive research 2 minutes at a time, and it was long and brutal, but I felt it was important to really do that. But
is she bringing your questions? Wait, is she bringing somebody?
She is, yes. We're not going to say who, but she is.
Oh, special guest. Okay.
People know her.
Okay.
People know her. So, yeah. And with that, I will bid you farewell until tomorrow. And we have what is tomorrow?
Oh, don't forget, we got an SJ discussion coming up too, don't we?
Oh, that's right. I just talked about what we have tomorrow. This is Steve. I'm losing my mind. Cell phones tomorrow.
Cell phones tomorrow.
Yeah, and then SJ on Saturday. SJ and the Frustrated Atheist. Although I'm still unsure of what they're. Did you ever find out what they're discussing, Steve?
I'm not quite sure, to be honest.
We're so professional.
They're going to talk about something that's going to be interesting. Whatever. We're all going to laugh and have fun. There you go.
I think it has really something to do. It's something to do with the conflation of communism and atheism.
Oh yeah, that's what it is. Okay, so basically, her narrative is that atheism relates to communism, and she doesn't know what the fallacy of division is. So she thinks that just because there's communist regimes and state atheism, she thinks that because they are atheistic, that atheism somehow has the same inherent evils as an atheistic state. And she doesn't get it through her head. That doesn't follow at all.
Dumb.
Oh, I have told her straight out, SJ, this is a dumb freaking argument. I mean, this is like bottom of the barrel creationist level crap. You mean you have a PhD. Why would you ever sink to this level of just fuckery? But she thinks it's a good argument. I don't know why.
The creators of cell phone have a PhD. So we'll end on that just to put it out there. PhD does not translate to genius, as we've seen. I believe William Lane Craig has a PhD, correct? Kent Hovind has a PhD. Dr. Sun Genis has a PhD.
PhDs for everybody.
Yeah, right. You get like Oprah. You get a PhD. You get a PhD. All right, guys. Tomorrow,
David, you get a PhD.
Cell phone. Thank you again, sir, for coming on. This was a pleasure and so much fun. And I wish you the best in your project. And I actually will. I rarely do this, but I will go back to my Christian roots. I will say a prayer for you whenever you have Steve on your show, because you, sir, will need it.
You will need it.
Until tomorrow, guys.
Amen.
We'll see you then.
Non sequitur, your facts are uncoordinated.